This is KGVM 95.9 FM and KGVM.org. Today's program of Health and Happiness can be heard on Monday evenings at 7 p.m. Mountain Standard Time or on KGVM.org on the Internet. In addition, this program can be accessed on KGVM.org in the archives. I am Dr. Arliss Wood, psychologist, with Dr. Suzanne Wood, speech-language pathologist. We host this show with support from the Montana Psychological Association Public Education Committee. Most of our programs deal with issues of mental health, but with a good variety of other community presentations. Now, Dr. Suzanne introduces today's topic and guests.
Years ago, I read a book by the noted theologian, famed writer, and university researcher C.S. Lewis about the topic of death. It was a thick and scholarly book full of suggestions and information covering every aspect of death. Many years later, he met a very special woman and married for the first time. He said often that he had never been happier. Then, tragically, she became ill and died. A crushing blow. After this, he wrote another book about death. I read this one too. He apologized profusely for the first book. He now had actually experienced the death of a loved one, and he realized he had had no idea of the depths of grief and the overwhelming sadness that one can endure. The second book, titled A Grief Observed, was a thin book describing real feelings. Reading his books made me feel humble in reaching out to those in grief. C.S. Lewis said the one thing he could do that helped him feel better was simply to praise God. No specifics, just simple praise for anything and everything. Another woman whose husband had died and who was in profound pain and sadness discovered that going into her garden and digging in the warm soil was a comfort when nothing else could be. It's a difficult topic, death. We have with us today some professionals who make it their life's work to assist those struggling with the death of a loved one. Like C.S. Lewis and that woman we mentioned, they help us find that which can help give us comfort in this process. We'd like to welcome Tanya Healy. Good day, Tanya. Welcome.
Hello, Susan. Thank you so much for having us today.
We're very proud to have you to talk about what many consider a difficult topic, and tell us about your work, if you could, please, Tanya.
Mountains of Courage began in 2010 with a group of women in Bozeman who had come across an article on how much doctors were spending to keep people alive at end of life. And it was so profound for them that they really decided to open up the conversation with lots of people so that they could broach this topic of death and really talk about, you know, what things we should be planning for. And thus, in 2011, Mountains of Courage, the conference, was born. And it's really meant to be a place of gathering for people who want to talk about preparation and the process of death itself. So it's a space for open-hearted, light conversation around this very rich and deep topic.
And were you one of the founders, I take it, Tanya?
No, I was not. Susan Kreitzberg started this conversation in 2010. And since then, since 2011, the conference has been hosted annually in Bozeman, with 1 year pausing for COVID. But a group of women have gathered and volunteered to host this conference every year. I joined the crew in 2018 when I attended my first conference and very quickly joined the committee and have now since taken over what has become a formal nonprofit. Mountains of Courage is an actual nonprofit. And I am partnering with a person that I met at the 2018 conference. We have shared the same vision for growth with the conference and doing things beyond. And so Sarah is on the phone with us this morning. Sarah, would you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, everyone. My name's Sarah West. And like Tanya said, we met at the conference. Tanya is a death midwife and I am a death doula, which is very similar. We assist people and support them in all things kind of non-medical at the end of life, just like people often have a birth doula. But we blend really beautifully with hospice organizations to support them where they often don't have the staff or the resources to really support families. So we can do a lot of educational things to support families and patients at the end of life. But the conference has been a really meaningful thing to open those conversations and help people understand what their options are at the end of life. There's so much that happens that people do and feel obligated to do because it's all they know or all they've seen. And opening the conversation and really allowing people to explore what really feels right to them and really knowing their options creates a really beautiful experience at the end of life.
And so you all are dedicated to these propositions. Tell me, Sarah, and then Tanya, how you became interested in working with death and dying.
I grew up with a mother who was a hairdresser in a rural farming community in southern Idaho, and she would often get contacted by our neighbors who were homesteaders, you know, the original land settlers in the area when someone passed away in their family to go to the funeral home and do the person's hair or makeup or paint their fingernails. And as a child, she would oftentimes take me with her. And in our own family, we experienced a significant amount of death early on. I lost my first grandfather at the age of 6, and then my grandmother at the age of 12, and a cousin at, you know, the age of 13, and another one, you know, at the age of 20, and numerous childhood school friends through elementary school and high school, and just, you know, really experienced a lot of death and was very kind of fascinated by it, very comfortable with it, and was reached out to by a lot of these families surrounding us to care for and assist them, just to come sit with them at the end before I really knew that being a death doula or an end-of-life midwife was a thing. And when national certifications started coming up and being offered, I heard about them and I researched them and I looked into it and it was like, oh gosh, this is amazing. I've been doing this work without knowing that it was really a profession in that sense. And my mom went on to be a hospice nurse, and I was exposed to hospice patients, you know, and going with her to visit them. And so as I went on and got my own certification for being a doula, It just was something that I really embraced and fit really nicely into my life, and was very rewarding experience to really assist people and advocate for them at the end of life and help them have that experience and their family have the experience that they really wanted.
So you work not only with the person who's dying, but also with the family. Is that correct?
That is correct. Something that a lot of people don't know is that hospices traditionally, they work with the patient and the family, but once that hospice patient passes away, they're no longer able to support the family. That service ends and the family is on their own. They have, they can recommend the family attend grief support groups or other things like that. But as a hospice doula, or as a doula, not a hospice doula, but as a doula, you can continue to support the family for as long as the family wishes. And I have a lovely gentleman whose wife passed away a couple of years ago, who I continued to support for a year after his wife died. And, and it can be in all different ways. For him, it was, meal preparation and helping him organize some of his finances and just being there to be kind of emotional and moral support for him. It then became that he wanted to ski again, and he hadn't skied in more than 10 years, and he was 87, and he said, would you come with me, a half a day every week and take me skiing? And so it's being able to do unconventional things with these families and patients that the structure of a government foundation, with Medicare and Medicaid, doesn't allow. So.
And that's really perhaps when it's most needed. Just a little aside here, for those in the audience who aren't familiar with the word doula, we're familiar because of the birth of our grandchildren with doulas and medical help, but describe what a doula is for the audience.
Would you first spell it, please?
Tanya, do you want to build that?
Yes, it's D-O-U-L-A.
Ah, thank you.
And I'll just tack on here, too. I know we're moving forward, but the reason I'm involved with death, I think, was a life plan that I was not made aware of until I was much older. My mom died when I was 40, and so 15 years ago she died, and I was there bedside with her. It was very powerful, a very powerful and hard experience. But after that, I felt really called to be with people bedside, primarily because I had another friend locally who died, and so I visited her in her final days often. And I felt so called to do this work. I was pulled in the direction of doing doula work, but I also started to learn things that I didn't know when my mom died. Like, you can cuddle a dying person. There are things that you can do when someone is dying, and I didn't know that. And so I just stood bedside staring at her, and I wish I had known. So my desire is to share these possibilities with people who don't know, so that they go into the experience of losing a loved one or of dying themselves, knowing more, knowing that they have options and choice. And then I look back at my college days and time years ago. I have the C.S. Lewis book on my shelf right here, the first one that you were referring to. And I realize I took a death and dying course in college that I had forgotten about. So that's why I say I think my life's plan was for me to do this work. It just took me a few decades to get there. And death midwife is what I name myself. Midwife and doula is interchangeable. Birth doulas, birth midwives work together as a team, sometimes individually, to help bring a baby into this world and to support the person laboring and anyone else that might be there supporting the person laboring. And the same thing happens with death. you know, dying is a laborious experience. You labor through the process of death. You know, death can be quick, but as a whole, even those coming days and weeks, as things start to transition into active dying, the labor that goes into it is just like birth. It's just on the other end. So a death doula is there to serve the person and not fix them. Death is unavoidable. And so we're not there to fix them. We are there to keep a loving vigil and to ensure the dying person feels loved and supported right up until their last breath. As Sarah referenced, we're there to support the families of the dying person and their loved ones. And a midwife and a doula will provide non-judgmental support for the individual who's dying and the family. So no matter their belief structure, whether it's faith-based or they have none, we are simply there to help with the process. And so we respect and honor religious, spiritual, atheist, and agnostic preferences. We are also there to provide gentle therapeutic techniques that really ensure that compassionate care. So touch, sound, music can be very healing, scented oil. And the first thing that we experience after we're born is touch. And we are wrapped in this incredibly complex sheath. So touch on the way out is a really magical experience for both the dying person and the people that are losing their loved one. Working with the family after death.
I particularly like that aspect because after the funeral, people go home, but the grief is just probably starting in. And Arliss, as a psychologist, has told me for years that the average grieving time for the loss of a close loved one, the average is a year, so it could be much longer. And he's talked about how after 2 or 3 months, a lot of people feel like, okay, it's time for you to move on. You know, you're okay now. And their expectation is not based on the reality that person might be just now beginning to really feel the full effects. And oftentimes a job is lost or relationships sever because people don't understand that it takes longer than most of us would think to get through this process.
Well, and that's really true. Several years ago, we had a keynote speaker at our conference. Is it Dr. Mary Frances O'Connor?
Correct.
And she had published a book on the science of the grieving brain. And it was fascinating to hear the science behind grieving and how there's essentially three groups of people. One group move through grief very quickly. One group, it might take a year to 2 years to move through their grieving process. And then there's a whole third group that will never get through their grieving process without some sort of therapy. Talk therapy is really what they found helpful to move through that process. And it's been fascinating as a doula to see that really happen and, you know, to have those experiences where I've had people, you know, I know in my own right, I moved through grief very quickly. I've seen people who move through it, you know, in a year or two. And then I have a couple of families that I've worked through it that have lost people and they are still in grief mode. And it's been over 5 years and for them, it feels just like it was yesterday. So it's really fascinating to understand the science behind that and how everyone is so different and everyone's grief process is so different as well. And just like you said at the beginning, you know, one person needs to do one thing, another person might need to garden, another person might need to do art therapy, another person might, you know, need to talk about it.
Do you see?
Yeah, grief.
Do you
grief
see?
Grief is not. Oh, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Grief is not a disorder or an illness. There's really no closure with grief. We just have to flow through it. And I've heard it stated that it's a black thread that is woven into the tapestry of life. And, you know, grief mirrors a tide. It comes in waves. And sometimes it's a very long time after the loss. The slightest thing might trigger us. And that's good. That's our body and our brains processing. Because when a person dies, they're no longer available. But our brain doesn't know that. For some people, they may be available in different ways. But our brain doesn't know that they're gone. We have to train our brain to say, hey, we can't pick up the phone and call dad anymore or sister. We can't mail them a card. All these things the brain has to learn, and that takes time. That takes time. And processing and allowing things to flow really is so much more healthy for the body and the mind than stuffing it down and not letting it flow. But yeah, society says after a few months, all right, you should be good. And that's not the case. That's not the case. So I appreciate you bringing that up, Susan.
Years ago, there was a book by Kubler-Ross about stages of grief, and others have said it was overly simplistic. And was it helpful? Or I know it doesn't follow exactly her plan, but how do you view her work?
You know, I respect and acknowledge those five stages of grief. They may not all happen to someone. They are not all inclusive. So, and they're not in order. It's denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. There are many more ways that grief can present. And there's no timeline for it either. They come and they go, just like those waves. They come and they go. So I do really appreciate that they were named. And I think that there was good intention in that. But it's a transforming experience, and it deserves time and space for all emotions to flow. And that looks different for all of us.
I'm wondering, having dealt with this so much, what you two would think about the person who, from the very beginning, says, oh, I'm just fine, and doesn't really process in the way that most people would. How do we help that person?
I think you have to be very willing to create a safe space and have really open conversations without forcing it. And I think we have to be willing to talk about our own fears and our own issues or feelings with it and just share. What I've found is that people are so willing to open up to me because I'm so willing to be open about my own experiences and my own desires for my own death. And that it's the willingness to say, you know, talking about death does not bring it sooner. It does not make it happen. It's going to happen to all of us. And talking and acknowledging that someone has passed doesn't mean that, you know, we're making it more acceptable. It's, or that we're going to forget them if we don't talk about it. We need to allow people the space to talk about it and to acknowledge those feelings and be open in a really safe environment. And, you know, I find that for some people, even acknowledging, you know, talking about people that have passed, they want to say they're over it and they don't want to face those fears. They don't want to open their own Pandora's box. of what it might look like for them, or that they might not be handling grief right. But in the same sense, they don't want to talk about their own experience of what their death will look like for them. And they don't want to face it even when it's staring them right back in the mirror. And, you know, it might be because they're uncomfortable because they're not on the same page with their own family members or those around them. And that's why those conversations are so important. There are things we need to talk about that we may want at the end of life medically that are not in alignment with what our family members would like us to have. They might be invasive treatments. They might be, voluntarily giving up food and liquids. They might be, medical aid in dying. There are conversations that we need to have so that we're all informed and informed as to why we want them, why our family members might want them, and what that means. And without opening the doors to those conversations, we're left with experiences at the end of life that are not as positive as they can be. We don't know when we're going to die, but the more open conversations we have about death and what we want at the end of life, the better prepared we can be to have the kind of experience we want.
Thank you. And yes, that makes good sense here as we talk about this. Just to make things even more complicated, sometimes people following the death of a loved one feel like they wanted to go too. They didn't want to keep living. And so how do you detect when a person might be suicidal following a family death? Because we do know that that can prompt further discord and more deaths. So do you have to keep watch for that? How do you determine what to do when you see that potential?
I personally have not experienced that or witnessed that in any of the scenarios that I've worked with. I can imagine that it might be very tough, but I think grief can look like depression. And, I'm not a clinical therapist, but I can watch out for certain signs, right? We all process grief in a different way, but suicidal thoughts and suicidal tendencies are something completely different. And if I were exposed to those signs, however they might present with someone, we actually have a sponsor of the conference. The American Foundation for Suicide Prevention is a sponsor of the conference. And so we have resources on site for people to take materials home. And I've also researched and studied those materials. And so if those signs came up, I think providing a resource for the individual and alerting family members or friends to really be aware and observe what's happening.
That's helpful.
Sarah, have you had a different experience, Sarah?
No, I think similar experiences. I have dealt with someone who, a family member who had lost someone tragically. And then after that death, they were experiencing suicidal tendencies and did try to act on it several times. And it was there, and there were signs that we recognized and signs that the family, we tried to intervene with medical care and therapy and different things. And, there were, various, there were a couple of attempts, and we were finally able to get this person some treatment and able to deal with some PTSD issues that he had had, and he's living a very happy, healthy, productive life. But you do have to watch for those signs, and you have to be engaged and just because you see the signs and you're engaged in trying to offer treatment doesn't mean that you'll always be successful at attempting to stop something like that. As we know, we don't have control over other people's lives in that manner, but you know, being aware, being engaged, being willing to have those conversations is so important.
Yes, I remember another radio show we did several years back, and it was a group of survivors of suicide who were talking about their journey. The research tells us that if a person dies by suicide, it's exponentially a greater chance that somebody close to them might act similarly. So in this group, one of the mothers who'd lost her son to suicide said, "I really wanted to go with them with all my heart, but the only reason I wouldn't allow myself to do that is because I know how much it hurts those who are left behind, and I couldn't do that to the rest of my family." So I guess when there is a suicide, we need to be aware that we really need to leap to the support of those left behind in the wake.
I think that's so important. So important. To be willing to have that conversation of, we recognize that this can be so much more difficult because of the nature of what happened. And, you know, these are things to watch for in your own self as well, that you might be feeling these things. And let's have a conversation.
Here in Southwest Montana, we have the Help Center, which is can be accessed either through calling 988 or 411 locally. And I would think that you all would be a great resource when people call in to be able to get in touch with you. How would one get in touch with you?
You can visit our website, which is mountainsofcourage.org. That's mountains with an S, many mountains of courage. And you can email us. You can send us a message via the website. You can also give us a call. That phone number, I believe, is on the website. I'm going to have you edit this part out because we got a new phone number and I don't know what it is. And it's currently not working. So we'll leave it at email and messaging for now. So, yes, they can reach out to us at the website. They can also attend the conference, which is Saturday, March 29th. It's from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. And we offer in-person registration, but new this year, we are offering online virtual attendance. We bring in wonderful speakers every year, and I'm not just saying that because I'm a part of the organization. It's several of us who come up with possible keynote speakers. We vote on it, and then we see who's available. And this year we have Dr. Michael Fratkin. He is the pioneer of telemedicine, and he will be speaking on psychedelic assisted therapy at end of life and how this may help with demoralization that happens oftentimes at end of life. Local Lorca Smetana is presenting on human resilience during grief. And Suzanne O'Brien is a globally known death doula and RN who is live streaming in to review her new book, The Good Death. The Good Death is a book that is being translated into, I think it was 27 different languages. It's releasing later in March this year, and we will have it available for sale at the conference. You can also get it on the website. Suzanne is live streaming in to take us through her book. It was written for anyone who is helping a loved one die, who is preparing for their death, or who may have experienced death and just needs some guidance. So it's a wonderful book for anyone, really, because death does affect all of us at some point.
Suzanne and I, when she was preparing for today, came across a very sensitive topic, but one in which the living seem to be really obsessed with sometimes, and that is finding humor about death. There's nothing humorous to me about death, but there are obviously those of us who maybe get anxious about many things, including dying, tend to want to joke about it and perhaps not think about it seriously. But is there a place in your working with people who are dying and their families, is there a place for humor?
I believe that there is.
Go ahead, Sarah.
I've experienced a lot of death in my own family. I lost a brother and I lost my dad a few years ago, you know, at a very, very early age for him. He was in his early 60s and he had a long battle with a degenerative disease. But with both of them, we had done so much preparation in knowing that they were going to pass, and they had gone through our grieving process in a lot of ways while they were alive. And we held a funeral the week after my brother's death, and I remember people coming through the line at the funeral home and saying things, and as a family, we were able to remember happy memories with my brother and jokes and things that he would do and quirky little things. And for me, there was a lot of room for humor in death. And it was very therapeutic for me that this death didn't have to be such a sad thing, that there was a lot of happiness and happy memories around it. And I think just being willing to allow space for humor and lighten the mood a little and not make it so serious or heavy, even when you're talking with someone. I had another client who was this fierce woman who had grown up in the Amelia Earhart era, and she was a pilot. She was one of the first women pilots that would participate in the women's powder puff airplane race across the country. And when I worked for her, she would say, "I'm never going to die." She would tell that to her family and friends all the time, that she was never going to die. And at one point, she was in the hospital actively dying because she had had a terrible fall. And I was talking to her family while we were sitting there, and I said, you know, this is our opportunity to take her home and allow her to die at home. If you want that, if she wants that, like, this is something we need to have this conversation about. And she piped up and said, "I'm not dying, Sarah." And I said, "But you are, we all are." So, you know, we all have to embrace that. And we had a good laugh about it. And, I think there's some room for it. I think death doesn't have to be so heavy and so serious. I think it's very situational and you have to know your audience, but I think there is a place for it.
Well, one thing we do know, there's deep, profound support for the psychological value of a good laugh. Just laughing makes you feel better. There's so much research about that.
And also there are different cultures. Obviously, there's great celebration about when someone dies. It seems to be a time for people to renew relationships and celebrate the person's life. So I would say that as a part of trying to have a transition to happiness again.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that one of the things we're really trying to do is open that conversation that there are so many options and so many different ways to do things, and that there's not any right way or wrong way to do things. You can do whatever you want for your death to look like. When my father was dying, I obviously had been through my doula training and had a lot of experience, and my mother was a hospice nurse, and we had so many conversations together with my mom and I and with my father and then with my siblings and his siblings about what his death would look like, what he wanted, what we wanted as a family. And not everyone was always in alignment. And I remember his younger sister saying to me, when he hits the end, like, he's going to starve to death. That's part of his disease process. And I said, yes, it is, unless, you know, he wanted, you know, IV, you know, food and drink, you know, hydration. That way, he, that is part of his natural disease process, is that he would starve to death if something didn't take him before that. And she said, but you'll do that for him. You will, you know. And I said, no, we won't, because that's a conversation we've had, and he does not want that. And she said, so you're just going to let him starve to death? And I said, I am, because that is what he wants. That is what we want. And that is the kind and compassionate thing to do, to honor his wishes and to support him through that. He does not have a quality of life. Why would we impose living longer if that's not what he's choosing? We need to, as a society, start to accept that it's okay to die when your body's shutting down, and to embrace that and not force people to live longer than they should.
I know there's been a lot of discussion, arguments about euthanasia. We had a chance to vote for that. We lived in Oregon at the time, and then in another state. And I think Oregon is one of those that voted yes. I actually voted yes. I know that's a very difficult topic. How do you all approach that?
Mountains of Courage is a non-political, non-religious, non-denomination organization. So, you know, Sarah and I are humans, right? We're individuals, and we have autonomy over choice. And I think that's the key word, is choice. Medical aid in dying, referred to as MAID, is not an easy decision to make. Whether you're a proponent or you're opposed to that process, it's all about choice and option. And if medical aid in dying is not available in your state, it currently is in Montana. It is, I think it's in the Senate level at this point. It passed legislature to overturn it. And I'm not going to speak to that. I'm not super politically inclined, well-versed. So I'll let that be. So what that means is, right now, an individual who is dying or has been diagnosed terminally ill, who wants to end their life, they can work with a physician. There are lots of steps that you have to go through to get to the point of being able to take a medicine, I'll call it, to end your life. And you have to actually do it. That is an option. If it's not an option, there are other ways that people can choose to die. VSED, which is what Sarah just referred to with her father, and that is voluntary stopping eating and drinking. And that's a way that you can die as well. So there, you have options and choice. I believe in having as many options and choice as possible, including how you die and where you die. Do you want to be at home? Do you want to be in a hospice facility in the hospital? Do you want to be at your favorite lake house or cabin in the woods? And then disposition of the body. How do you want to be buried? With a funeral, in a casket, a green burial, in a biodegradable material that is buried, cremation, funeral pyres, resumation. There are so many choices with disposition of body. I believe that we need choice when it comes to how we die and where we die. So I hope that answered your question.
Oh, yes. Very, very well. Yes.
I was going to say, I think we need choice as well in terms of having conversations with our physicians, and where it, through a pulse, a physician, you know, guided medical directive, or at the end of life. There are so many people that are now saying, you know, when they come down with a terminal diagnosis or something, and they go to the hospital, and the the doctor says, these are your options. You could have surgery, you could do this, some sort of invasive treatment. And people generally think that what they're being offered is going to buy them a significant amount of time in living longer. They're going to live, you know, months to years longer if they do this intervention, when the reality often is that it's buying them days to weeks, and that the quality of life that they have in going through these medical interventions significantly decreases, and they come through the other side and they're saying, had I known the quality of my life was going to decrease and it was going to be that difficult, I would have never done the intervention, and I would have rather just dealt with what I was dealing with, had quality of life, and passed away sooner. So I think we need to have those conversations of, do you want quality of life or do you want quantity of life? And these are the options you might have. And I think medical doctors need to start having those conversations, but we as family, friends, people in the medical community, doulas, hospices, nurses, need to be open to having those conversations with people of, do you want quantity of life? Do you want quality of life? And what are you living for today? What is bringing you happiness today? Or what would make your life feel better today?
You're making such excellent points. Suzanne and I have a personal situation that I add this to the conversation about how complicated it really gets sometimes, is that I have a brother who was born with cerebral palsy, developmentally disabled, didn't walk till he was 4 or 5, etc. Went through his life living with my mother for many years. Suzanne and I intervened and helped him at about age 40 to be out in an independent living facility, and which he did extremely well for the next 20 or 30 years. Then he had to go to a nursing home because of debilitating illnesses. But I'm getting around to this point. It's about 3 years ago, the nursing facility he was in, we get a phone call and that from a hospice group that said, your brother's probably going to die within a month, said that we need to put him on hospice. Well, we visited him often, and we knew that wasn't the case. He had trouble communicating. Some people didn't understand where he was emotionally, mentally. Anyway, long story short, is that he died 2 weeks ago. And so we had to deal with hospice now and then saying, well, it's time. But it really wasn't time for him, and we knew that. And he had an aide that worked with him who also knew that. We had a physician that very much understood him. So it's very complicated at times. What I'm trying to say is it takes a very educated family, I think, to know when to give permissions or non-permissions. And may I say at the end, hospice did really, really great. They were there about 2 weeks and did all the things, in my opinion, that hospice could and should do at their best. And I'll compliment them greatly on that. But anyway, it gets complicated sometimes.
It does get complicated. And when we're at the end of life with somebody, people often wait too long to sign up for hospice because of that fear of facing death or dealing with death or acknowledging it. And the research is so solid that the sooner somebody signs up for hospice, the more stable they are and the longer and better quality of life they will have. And I believe that's true, whether it's hospice or hiring a doula to support you through that process. But the sooner we acknowledge it and deal with it, the sooner you have an educated professional on your side advocating for you that can help you have the quality of life that you want at the end and buy some time. And I think there's nothing worse than going, you know, into a hospice situation right at the end where you're signing up for hospice, and I call it the business of death, where you go to the doctor, your loved one is declining, they're told that they need to go on hospice, you know, finally, you know, they might have been told that you know, many months or years prior, and they've avoided it. No, we're doing fine. We'll keep getting through. And they finally need to go on. And it's the decision of, we've got to choose a hospice, and then we've got to, you know, get set up with them, and we've got to get all the medical equipment, the hospital bed or whatever you need, and they've got to come visit. And you have this whole army of people coming in from hospice. You have the hospice nurse, you have the CNAs, you have hospice volunteers, you have a hospice chaplain, all coming to see and support you, but it's taking time away from you sitting and spending quality time with your loved one right at the end when it's so important. And then if you've not done the business of preparing for their death and planning their funeral, or knowing, you know, pre-writing an obituary, knowing who you're getting flowers from, or if you're doing flowers, or what you're doing for a funeral, or what funeral home you're using, when your loved one dies, instead of sitting in your grief, you now are in the business of attending all these meetings and making plans when you're in the worst possible mental state to do that. And when you should be able to sit in your grief and remember your loved one, you're busy planning their death, you know, their funeral at the end, or how to wrap up and tie up loose ends and get death certificates and close accounts and all of those things. And I just, the more people can be prepared and do ahead of time, the better that is at allowing you to sit in your grief and really process your loss and spend quality time with your loved one right at the end.
Well expressed.
I had a quick thought since we're getting near the end here, but there's something that might be unavoidable. And maybe all we need to do is acknowledge what it actually is. But Arliss has talked a lot about seeing something called survivor's guilt among those who've lost loved ones.
Yes.
And could you maybe speak to that for a moment? It's something that's not called on or asked for, but it does happen.
I see that a lot in PTSD veterans that I have counseled, yes.
Tanya, do you want to step in or?
Go ahead.
You know, I have not had a lot of experience with survivor's guilt, honestly. So I can't speak to that as well as hopefully Sarah can.
I have dealt with some families and some people who have experienced survivor's guilt. And I think, again, it's something that as doulas and as professionals in the industry, we have to watch for signs and symptoms of, and we have to be willing to have conversations. And I think those conversations that we have ahead of time, prior to someone's passing, when we can, are so helpful in acknowledging and creating a safe space that this is something that might come up and that we're a safe space to talk about it with, or making recommendations for professional help with counselors and psychologists. You know, I think that it's important. I think that people feel guilt. People feel that they could have done more. I think that the more we normalize death and the passing of individuals, the more helpful we're going to be as a society in accepting this. Death is inevitable. Everyone is going to experience it. We are all going to have loss. And it's okay. We don't, we can't avoid it. And we need to accept it and acknowledge it. And there are wonderful ways we can memorialize and remember our loved ones without feeling guilt. And I think that, you know, it's just watching and having conversations when we see that that's a potential.
Where I've seen this more acutely is with veterans who were in combat and someone sure. was killed right next to them. And why was it he and not me? So,
right.
But yeah, it happens in other cases as well.
Well, we had a neighbor who was killed riding his bicycle in Bozeman a couple of years ago. And I remember saying to someone, you know, that person who ran over him, oh my goodness, why did he do that? And then the person I was speaking to said, well, he's my neighbor, and there's no way he'll ever get over this. So survivor's guilt, you know, sometimes you were in a car accident that maybe if you'd put on the brakes a little bit sooner, you keep questioning yourself. So I think a lot of support needs to be provided for those who are dealing with an unusual circumstance such as that.
I agree. I agree 100%. It's there. It is a very common thing with veterans. I've seen it with members of my own family who are veterans and lost people next to them. And it's changed them, and it's a very difficult thing for them. You know, I've also seen it with tragic accidents that have happened in the community. And I think we do have to acknowledge and support those people and just be aware, I think, of those circumstances that might be that. I think you also see it less common, but in individuals, you know, older couples who, you know, or a parent who loses a child unexpectedly, or an older couple who loses a spouse, and it's like, I can't go on without them. I wish it was me instead of them. And I think we have to offer support structures to those people that it is difficult, and it's okay to acknowledge that it is difficult, and you're going to have good days and bad days and ups and downs, and that there are tools to help get through this. And we start with the basics of getting up every day and getting dressed and doing things. And we go through the motions and we talk about things, and it will get better.
We'd like to thank you for being on the program today. Would you all like to make a closing statement? We have about 90 seconds.
Yes. I just wanted to add in regard to humor around death, is that obviously there are some deaths that there is no humor with it. There are other deaths that there are, and it naturally comes forth. And one thing to keep in mind with that is having children and pets around. Children bring such a lighthearted approach to life in general that it's important for them to experience death. It can be hard, but it can be lighter and beautiful when children and animals are around. And yeah, I just want to say thank you so much for having us, and that death is not an event. It's a process. It's a slow unraveling, just as in birth. And it's as certain and as sacred as life. So we really need to be talking about it and preparing for this very natural thing that happens.
And I just want to quote Stan Laurel of Laurel and Hardy, a lifelong comedian of great renown. He said, "If any of you cry at my funeral, I'll never speak to you again."
That's wonderful. And if people want to hear more, I am hosting a couple of mortality meetups on March 18 and March 25th. You will be able to find information for those events on the website. They're here in Bozeman, and it's a one-hour talk, Living Fully with Death Planning and Taking Back Death, Finding Autonomy in Death Planning.
Thank you again so much. I'd like to remind the audience, this is KGVM 95.9 or KGVM.org. If you're not able to listen to this when it's presented the first time, go to KGVM.org and you can find it in the archives. Thank you again, and tune in again next week. Thank you.